Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Today, we're very fortunate to have a terrific guest joining us in the studio here at WILL 580 AM in Urbana, John Stauber. John Stauber is probably one of the leading experts on the public relations industry in the United States today, along with his running mate, Sheldon Rampton. He has written three very well-received, prominent books that relate to the public relations industry. John Stauber is based in Madison, Wisconsin, where he is the director of the Center for Media and Democracy, and where he operates the website PRWatch.org and the puts out the quarterly publication PR Watch. John Stauber, welcome to Media Matters.
Thank you very much, Bob. I'm happy to be here. That was a lot of information to give out.
Yeah, well, there's going to be an exam at the end of the show, so people better be writing this down or they're going to be in big trouble. This show, by the way, for the sake of our listeners, is part of our June series in which we've been taping people in late May and early June who've been coming through town to get them in the studio. So today, as with all the other shows during the month of June, we'll not be taking telephone calls. So just sit back, relax, and listen to John Stauber for the next 55 minutes, if you will. John, I think a lot of people listening to the show, some I know are going to be familiar with your work, but a lot of them aren't going to be familiar with your work or really know much about public relations. You know, it's such an important institution in our society, yet if you go to the library and you look up public relations, you hardly see anything. You know, if you look up advertising or journalism, or if you look up movies or something, the card catalog, the computer starts smoking, the card catalog gets directed, or you look up public relations, barely anything. It's really interesting. Why is that? Why do you think public relations, you know, as an institution, is so unexamined in our society?
Well, public relations is really just a euphemism invented by Eddie Bernays for the practice of propaganda.
Eddie Bernays, is he a friend of yours? Who's that?
I actually did talk with Eddie Bernays once. I gave him a phone call in 1995 when he was 103 years old, shortly before his death. Eddie Bernays is sort of a well-kept secret in America, too, but he was certainly one of the most influential and interesting intellectuals and professionals of the previous century. And he's known, in the words of Larry Tye, who wrote a book with this title, as the father of spin, or the father of the public relations industry. Eddie Bernays really invented the business of public relations, and it's absolutely true that we don't hear much about public relations. In fact, when Sheldon Rampton and I wrote our first book, Toxic Sludge is Good for You, one of the two admonitions from our publisher was, don't put public relations in the title of this book, because no one wants to pick up a book about public relations. PR is sort of an unpleasant topic. People understand it means spin and manipulation, but we all think we're too intelligent, cynical, sophisticated, well-read, well-educated, just smart to get fooled by PR propaganda.
So PR is propaganda, is what you said?
Absolutely. PR is the business of propaganda. It's a multi-billion-dollar business, but it is very secretive. It was you who years ago introduced us to Alex Carey's great book, Taking the Risk Out of Democracy, which is now available in the United States. And something in that book became a touchstone for the work we do at Center for Media and Democracy, which is, as Carey put it, this observation that the 20th century was marked by three great developments: the rise of democracy and democracy movements around the world, the rise of the power of corporations, and the rise of propaganda, corporate propaganda, to protect corporate power from democracy. Mm-hmm. And thanks to people like Eddie Bernays, the business of propaganda, the public relations industry, exists in the United States, and it's massive, it's hidden, and despite what we all think of our own ability to detect spin, we're all very susceptible to it.
Now, before we go any further, I think it's an interesting story for you to tell our listeners how you, John Stauber, became interested in this issue. I mean, because it wasn't like you were reading a bunch of philosophy books in the Yale Department of Philosophy in some seminar. But instead, you came to an interest in public relations from an entirely different route. Could you tell us how that took place?
Absolutely. A lot of people assume that I must be some renegade who used to be involved in advertising or public relations or political consulting and sort of came back from the dark side to tell stories about propaganda campaigns. Actually, my entire adult life, and I'm pushing 50, has been spent as a community activist, community organizer, public interest activist, working on a variety of public interest issues. In 1988, Jeremy Rifkin asked me if I would work with his organization, the Foundation on Economic Trends, to organize consumers and farmers around this issue of genetically engineered bovine growth hormone, a new multi-billion-dollar product being developed by the Monsanto company, a genetically engineered drug injected into cows every day to force more milk out of them, has serious consequences for the cows. There are unknown human health risks that haven't been investigated. And every opinion survey showed people don't want this. People like the old-fashioned milk. You know, if you ask people, how would you like your milk? Do you want it to come from cows that are injected with a needle every day and given a hormone? Most people who buy milk say, hold the hormone. So there was a huge lobby and public relations campaign around this. And unfortunately, this product has been approved. It's on the market, and there's no consumer labeling, thanks to both Republican and Democratic administrations.
You mean, if I go to buy milk after the show today, go to the store and buy milk, I could be buying this injected milk and not know it?
You're almost certainly buying milk that's mingled with milk from cows that are injected with this genetically engineered drug every day. And in the countries of Europe, in Canada, in New Zealand, in Australia, this drug has never been approved and it never will be approved simply because of its animal health problems. But here in the U.S., it's on the market with no consumer labeling. And that was the essence of this massive probably $100 million lobby and PR campaign by big corporate interests, including Monsanto, Eli Lilly, American Sinomed, companies developing the drug.
And you were on the other side.
Right. I was.
They were spending $100 million. You were spending $100.
$100, that's right. right. I was in Wisconsin organizing farmers and consumers. Then State Senator Russ Feingold was our champion on this issue, simply trying to win the right for consumers to know. I mean, this is America.
It wouldn't have even abolished it. It just would have made it so beyond the label.
Right. But since people, if they had that much information, many of them would avoid it.
Companies
that give such lip service to the free market, if the free market is actually going to work against their economic interest or some lousy product like a drug you inject cows to force more milk out of them, then you have to circumvent the free market. And that's what they did. But what was interesting was when I started working on this campaign in 88, it was clear to me there was tremendous collusion between and among the regulatory agencies, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and the genetic engineering companies developing this, the big supermarket and dairy companies that were in favor of it. So I did a couple of Freedom of Information Act investigations and was able to obtain thousands of pages of internal strategy documents outlining this vast PR campaign using entities like the American Medical Association and the American Dietetic Association as so-called third-party experts to go to bat for this drug. Finding out that the USDA's National Dairy Board hired a spy firm to infiltrate a dairy farmer event in New York and have these PR operatives pretend to be housewives, apparently to try to convince journalists that housewives wanted this drug. And what really got me investigating this massive PR industry and the way it works and for major corporations and for products like bovine growth hormone was finding myself spied upon by what was then the world's largest PR firm and is still one of the biggest, Burson Marsteller, who formed a group called Maryland Concerned Citizens, Maryland. I forget the name exactly. It's in our book.
It's right out of Orwell's playbook when they come up with these names, isn't
yeah.
it?
I mean, yeah. Well, a woman called me out of the blue and said, look, you know, we're housewives in Maryland, and we have a consumer group here, and we're very concerned that if this hormone comes on the market, our school kids, our kids, are going to have to consume milk from cows in this drug, and we really don't want that. We understand you have a meeting in Washington. Could we attend?
Yeah, you're fired up, right? You're thinking,
this is wonderful. Sure.
Yeah, this is what yeah. you're looking for.
Yeah. Here's some real concerned housewives. They have a consumer organization. Great. Well, the organization, if it ever existed, no longer existed then except as a front for Burson Marsteller. Their client on this issue was the Eli Lilly company. And Eli Lilly and Monsanto, American Sanamid, and Upjohn were all sharing their PR information. This was just a classic spy operation to get people into a meeting of real citizens groups like Consumers Union, Humane Society of the United States, National Farmers Union, and find out what the heck us dangerous, concerned, real concerned citizens were up to. So after being spied on by the world's largest PR firm and getting all these internal documents showing how this loser of a product, bovine growth hormone, was being forced onto the market with no consumer right to know, it just dawned on me that every controversial issue, in fact, even issues around which there isn't a controversy yet, but a controversy is anticipated.
Potential controversy.
There are PR experts working for corporations and trade associations to manage public opinion, manage media coverage of events, and make sure that public policy is that a public policy outcome favorable to the Fortune 500 is the result.
And the truth is purely incidental to their activities. I mean, they're liars for hire.
Well, the truth is interesting. In our book, Trust Us, We're Experts, we look at how the PR firms consider the truth. And basically, the truth is a commodity they create.
Mm-hmm.
If
they get you to believe something, then it's true.
Then it's true. We quote John Scanlon, who is no longer with us. He died last year. But it was a major PR crisis management
consultant.
Probably
from too much bovine milk or whatever.
Well, it's hard to say. John did a lot of work for the tobacco companies.
Okay.
In fact, in the movie The Insider,
mm-hmm.
which I hope people have seen, forget all these other Russell Crowe movies. This is the Russell Crowe movie to see. That's the one he should have won the Academy Award for. The Insider, which is the story of how CBS 60 Minutes,
yeah.
bowed to the pressure of tobacco companies and left this very courageous, real-life tobacco whistleblower, the scientist Jeffrey Wigand, played by Russell Crowe in the movie, left him hanging out to dry. In the movie The Insider,
mm-hmm.
there is a PR person whose job was to smear Jeffrey Wigand by compiling just the nastiest bunch of half-truths
mm-hmm.
and taking them around to major media like the Wall Street Journal. That was John Scanlon.
All right.
He was actually named in a lawsuit for a while, but
and he was the one who came up with the idea, if you convince people to believe it, it's true? Is that?
He calls the truth a liquid. The truth is not a solid. The truth is a liquid, and whoever best defines the truth in the public mind creates the truth.
I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters today on WILL AM 580 here in beautiful Urbana. Our guest in the studio in Campbell Telecommunication Hall is John Stauber, author with Sheldon Rampton of three wonderful books, including Toxic Sludge is Good for You, their first classic book on public relations, Mad Cow USA, Could the Nightmare Happen Here, which came out 4 years ago, 97 was that?
97.
Also with Sheldon Rampton. And then their most recent book, which is just doing gangbusters, Trust Us, We're Experts, which came out 2 years ago, I think a year and a half ago. And also it's How Industry Manipulates Science and Gambles with Your Future. And what we've been talking with John so far about is how he came to understand the importance of public relations, PR, and all the sort of environmental and public health issues he was organizing around as an activist in Wisconsin and nationally. One thing that comes out in your books that you talk about a lot that I think you've already alluded to it, but a lot of people don't really quite understand because it's really quite amazing, are what's called the third party technique.
Mm-hmm.
Could you, and also grassroots, AstroTurf, movements or groups. Could you talk about both those? And you give a couple of examples, because I think it, when people understand this, then they're going to look at the world a lot differently when they start seeing political debates going on.
Well, I referred to the Australian academic Alex Carey and his work in investigating propaganda. And he pointed out that corporate propaganda exists to protect corporate power from democracy. And in our society, where we have democratic institutions, we see advertising. I mean, obviously, advertising is a massive form of propaganda, but at least most advertising is in our faces. It's out there. Hopefully, you know, when you see the ad in the newspaper or the magazine or on television or hear it on the radio, something critical clicks in and you go, well, maybe he's not the best candidate in the world. Maybe that soap isn't going to solve all my problems. You know, maybe BO isn't the worst thing in my life. We're just deluged with over 1,000 advertising messages a day. But at least those, to some degree, are visible. And the whole idea of public relations is
invisibility. I mean, you know someone's selling you something. Advertising,
you should be aware of it.
In fact, it's a bad ad, I would think. If you don't know who sponsors the ad, that's the worst thing you could have. It's like,
that's right.
Well, that was a great ad, but, gee, I don't remember what the product was.
Right. A big emphasis on advertising is to build, you know, what's called brand loyalty, to really brand the consumer consciousness with the desire for a product or the desire to be one with the image of the product. But the whole idea of public relations and propaganda is invisibility. If Monsanto is telling us that genetically engineered food is safe, well, you know, we might remember that they were the company that brought us Agent Orange and brought us PCBs and
And that they stand to make a lot of money from it.
And that they stand to make billions from this. So
might
what are they going to say?
Might not think they're telling the whole story.
Right. Or if the coal industry tells us, gee, we're going to admit it, global warming seems to be happening, coal seems to be part of the reason. But good news, our scientists have discovered global warming is going to be beneficial. Well, hopefully people go, wait a minute, you're the coal industry. But if you turn on the radio and you hear a bright environmental scientist with an environmental group called the Greening Earth Society saying exactly that, that, well, it does appear that the climate is getting warmer and industrial activity over the last 150 years and fossil fuel gases are part of the problem. But it's really not a problem. We've looked at this in depth, and we're going to be able to grow pineapples in Illinois, and you know we're going to be able to have a lot more plant growth on the planet because carbon dioxide increases plant growth, and that's the major greenhouse gas, and this is actually an environmental plus. It sounds too good to be true, and hopefully whoever's interviewing the person from the Greening Earth Society has asked them where they get their money from. And it comes to light that, in fact, they're the creation of the coal industry. But often the media doesn't even bother to go into who are these experts that are out there promoting a particular side in environmental and health and safety debates.
So those are that's the third-party technique is to create these?
The third-party technique is essentially to put the message in the mouth of a trusted expert. You may have never heard of the Greening Earth Society. But if you hear them on the radio, you assume they're an environmental group, and they create this vast confusion over issues like global warming. Other groups that we write about and trust us we're experts are the American Council on Science and Health. They go back some 25 years and really helped create this idea that environmental and health and worker safety concerns over everything from pesticides to asbestos to environmental lead contamination is really just based on junk science. There's really no science out there, no credible science indicating we have to worry about these things. It's just these fear-mongering environmental groups out to raise money for their own cause by scaring the bejeebers out of consumers. The American Council on Science and Health, what a wonderful sounding name. Who could be against
sounds
it?
Sounds like you grandma know? Would belong to that one.
And indeed, they have a list of hundreds of prominent scientists very carefully chosen, right-wing, industry-funded academics, typically.
Carefully paid off, might I ask?
And, you know, they are a hardcore pro-industry, industry-funded front group. And yet they get tremendous press because they have a huge budget provided by industry, and they're out there, again, sowing tremendous confusion with what sound like common sense or scientific or objective arguments coming from a third-party independent group of experts. It's an environmental front group. So there you have the combination of the third-party technique. Get somebody like Dr. Siever Koop to say that mad cow disease isn't going to kill you, that pesticides are safe.
The former Surgeon General.
The former Surgeon General.
Was fairly well-respected, I think, in general.
Extremely well-respected because when he was in the Reagan administration, he stood up to his own administration on issues of tobacco and AIDS prevention.
Yeah, suspected of having integrity.
Yeah, he really spoke out. And so that made him somebody the public trusts.
So ideal for third-party technique.
Ideal for third-party technique. And on issues like tobacco, Dr. Siever Koop has the public interest at heart, but he has a very fond place in his heart for some reason for toxic pesticides. Mm. Bovine growth hormone, genetically engineered food, and mad cow disease.
I suspect he might have a fond place in his wallet for them, but who knows for sure. Now, what about the grassroots groups, or excuse me, AstroTurf groups? What's that term refer to?
AstroTurf is a term that I believe former Senator Lloyd Bentsen, former Secretary of the Treasury Lloyd Bentsen, you know, an old hand in Washington who's a lobbyist himself these days, came up with to derisively criticize front groups for industry that are whipping up what appears to be massive public support for industry side of an issue. The classic AstroTurf group is something like the National Smokers Alliance, which is an organization created by Philip Morris and other tobacco companies, spending probably, again, hundreds of millions of dollars over years and years building a massive database of some 3 million individuals out of the universe in the U.S. of some 26 million smokers. And then when the local city council is entertaining an ordinance to protect the public from secondhand cigarette smoke, or OSHA is developing a regulation to protect workers from cigarette smoke, Philip Morris, through firms like Burson Marsteller, use their money to get these 3 million folks deluging elected officials with letters, with phone calls, arguing, hey, smokers' rights. And this organization wouldn't exist. It's not a real grassroots group, but for the creation of the tobacco industry.
I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters Today on WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. My guest you've been listening to is John Stauber, director of the Center for Media and Democracy in Madison, Wisconsin, and I think arguably the leading expert on public relations, the role it plays in our politics in the United States. Along with his running mate, Sheldon Rampton, he's co-authored three terrific books on the subject, Toxic Sludge is Good for You, Mad Cow USA, Could the Nightmare Happen Here?, and most recently, Trust Us, We're Experts, How Industry Manipulates Science and Gambles with Your Future, which was published by...
By the Tarcher Division of Putnam Penguin.
Putnam Penguin, a terrific press, and it's got a nice Tom Tomorrow cartoon on the cover, one of my favorite cartoonists. And it's a terrific book. I've read it, used it in classes. And if you're, you know, if you really want to get a lot of information, I mean, it's not just like name calling. This is a book that is chock full of case study, example, hard information on how this process takes place. Because it's really when you see the tangible examples, like you're talking about, the real cases, that it dawns on you the significance of this phenomenon and how important it is. And it seems to me, from going back to what you're saying really about advertising compared to PR, I mean, the greatest successes in public relations would be the ones we'd have no idea about. If we can talk about them, they automatically can't be considered tremendous successes.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if we do know about them, they can only be successes if we know about them as postmortems, after the fact. You talk in your book and in your discussions a lot about some of the great examples of PR that people might not be aware of. The one I love that I use with my students is about the Gulf War. And maybe just tell our listeners, this is one of the, this is in the PR Hall of Fame, how PR basically changed fundamental public policy about a war in this country.
Right. And I think when people hear an interview with Sheldon Rampton or me on the radio, they often think, well, these must be aberrations, these examples they're giving. But as you point out, PR is pervasive. It's a multi-billion-dollar industry, and every corporation, elected official, government agency, wealthy individual these days doesn't make a move without their PR experts and PR campaigns. And one of the most outrageous examples of a public relations campaign in the U.S. was over a decade ago in the fall of 1990 when Saddam Hussein's army invaded Kuwait and occupied the oil fields and country of Kuwait. Within a week, the ruling family of Kuwait hired what was then the world's largest PR firm, the Hill & Knowlton Company.
Now they're number two?
Well, there's a few firms that are jockeying, but actually, this is a bit of an aside, but the public relations industry, like all other sectors of the economy, are so concentrated that now two of the major competitors for that title, Burson Marsteller and Hill & Knowlton, are both under the same roof at the WPP Group.
Which is one of the three largest ad agencies in the world.
Exactly. The big ad agencies that pump the billions into the media to make it go also own the biggest PR firms.
Okay.
And there's more and more conglomeration. But back in 1990, the ruling family of Kuwait turned to Hill & Knowlton and paid eventually over $10 million to the Hill & Knowlton firm to launch something called Citizens for Free Kuwait. Now, if people remember this, here in the U.S., there wasn't a tremendous amount of public outrage over Saddam Hussein seizing the oil fields of Kuwait, because at that time, Saddam Hussein was a beloved ally of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
This was the previous Bush administration. And there's even some evidence that the wrong political signal was given by the Bush administration to Saddam Hussein, and he thought he could get away with seizing the oil fields with impunity. But, of course, that wasn't the case. And the U.S. government really had some trouble at first developing messages that would resonate with the American people to support sending 500,000 troops over to Saudi Arabia and pushing Saddam's army out of Kuwait. The Hill & Knowlton PR firm and the Bush administration had a lot of interlocking characters. And through this group, Citizens for Free Kuwait, which was treated by the U.S. press as, again, a grassroots group, something that just arose to promote
classic
democracy in Kuwait.
Completely bogus AstroTurf group.
Yeah, it was completely funded by the government of Kuwait. Even though on campuses all around the U.S. there would be demonstrations by, you know, student groups affiliated with Citizens for Free Kuwait, those were actually organized by the Hill & Knowlton public relations firm.
In fact, listeners, stay tuned. It gets better.
The U.N. The U.N. Security Council was meeting in closed assembly in the U.N. building in New York, and somehow the Citizens for Free Kuwait got in with signs to demonstrate in favor of going to war. But the most outrageous incident was clearly this phony congressional testimony that really swung the political support in the U.S. Congress around behind the Bush administration in going to war. And
it underlined for listeners who might not remember that far back, the vote to authorize the war in the Senate came down to just one or two votes, as I recall.
Exactly.
So this is just swinging five votes is the difference between war and peace in the region.
Yeah, exactly. And days before that vote, there was held on Capitol Hill by the Congressional Human Rights Caucus what looked like a congressional hearing on Iraqi atrocities in occupied Kuwait. Of course, there were Iraqi atrocities in occupied Kuwait, but in this case, the real atrocities weren't enough. The Hill & Knowlton PR firm and Citizens for Free Kuwait, their client, the front group created by the ruling family of Kuwait, had to trump something up. So they really created this appearance of a congressional hearing. It wasn't a real congressional hearing because in a real congressional hearing, people are put under oath. So if you lie at a congressional hearing, you stand to face serious charges of perjury. But this was treated by the media as if it was a congressional hearing. There were real Congress people and the star witness.
And they got it on C-SPAN, didn't they?
Oh, they got it number one story on every program, every news program.
Yeah.
Because they had this gut-wrenching testimony from a young teenage girl whose full name was not given supposedly to protect her family back in occupied Kuwait. She was called Nayira. And in written and oral testimony, she tearfully described this horrible event she witnessed where Iraqi soldiers tossed infants out of incubators in the hospital she was volunteering at in Kuwait, left them to die by the hundreds, and took these incubators back to Iraq.
What, to use as sex aids or
whatever
something?
Whatever reason, you know. But this, I remember this well because at the time I didn't realize it was false testimony.
Well, it was striking. I remember it very well.
Yeah. It was corroborated by groups like Amnesty International. And then we had this phenomena of President George Bush, who never really cared for anything Amnesty International had to say, suddenly quoting Amnesty International and saying, look, these baby killers, shall not go unpunished. And it was probably the media event that pushed the congressional vote through to support the U.S. war in the Gulf. Whether you think the U.S. should have gone to war or not in the Gulf, I think most people are shocked and disturbed and outraged to discover, if they have discovered, that a year after this event, it came out thanks to John MacArthur at Harper's Magazine and an investigative crew from the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, that this young girl, Nayira, was in fact a member of the royal ruling family of Kuwait. In fact, she was the daughter of the U.S., of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the United States, who was in the room.
And she volunteered at a hospital.
So. Yeah, right. Wow. Yeah. And she was coached in this testimony by the Hill & Knowlton firm. In fact, Vice President of the firm, Lori Fitzpagato, coached her in this prepared testimony. And that this event that she swore she saw firsthand never occurred. It's sort of the oldest war propaganda tale ever. The
enemy was never in Kuwait, right? She was in America.
As far as anyone knows, she was never in Kuwait. She's never been forthcoming and spoken with the media. And there's never been any investigation of this because this wasn't a real congressional hearing. It was a group of congresspeople who have something called the Human Rights Caucus. Interestingly, many of the congresspeople had very dubious records on human rights. But the media played into it exactly the way Hill & Knowlton obviously planned it. And it was an outrageous act of deception.
It's in the Public Relations Hall of Fame, one of the great events in PR history, no doubt. It's sort of like among gamblers, the guy who fixed the 1919 World Series is sort of like held up as the guy who got the farthest. We're talking to John Stauber today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana. This is a show that we taped. We're doing a series of shows in June of guests who've come to town. In late May and early June, we taped these shows. And because of that, we aren't taking phone calls today. Just sit back and relax. When we go back live in July, you can start phoning in and talking to our guests again. You know, the people who work for PR firms, John, you've alluded to some of them. You know, I've taught at the University of Wisconsin before coming to Illinois, and I've seen a lot of people teach public relations, and I deal with a lot of students who've majored in it. And I think there's a general perception in the general public and among students that when you talk about people going to public relations, you're talking about sort of like fast-talking guys in leisure suits who are like pounding down daiquiris and slapping in the back and talking about the Bears and the Packers. Or you've got really well-dressed, bubbly young girls and boys who just want to be nice to everyone and smile. But the general sense you get that public relations isn't attracting really the high power talents or intellects. It's basically a lot of yahoos who just want to BS you. That does the sort of stuff you're talking about with Hill and Knowlton, who's getting us into a war, the sort of stuff you were talking about with bovine growth hormone, this doesn't seem like the sort of stuff that can be done by chuckleheads in leisure suits.
Well, let me say that there are chuckleheads in leisure suits working in the business of public relations, as in most other professions. But the public relations industry, the people who are really the cream of the crop are people who often come out of very prestigious political careers, former congresspeople, former journalists.
They fall off the public map. I mean, no one sees them where they're not in the radar of public attention. Yet now they're probably doing the most significant work of their careers and making by far the largest incomes.
Well, here's an example. Frank Mankiewicz.
Sure.
I mean, many people who listen to public radio are familiar with that name.
Mm-hmm.
Frank Mankiewicz was one of the closest confidants of the Kennedys, you know, worked on John Kennedy's campaign.
Bobby
Kennedy's campaign. He was George McGovern's campaign manager in the 1972 election versus Richard Nixon.
Well, last campaign he lost.
And, of course, that campaign was the one that involved the Watergate burglars, mm-hmm. you know, an incident that never came out, even though it had occurred and the burglars were arrested before the November election. There was no meaningful investigation. You know, just a real smear campaign. And Mankiewicz was on McGovern's side in that election. He then went to National Public Radio, was the president, I believe, of National Public Radio. Well, now he's at Hill and Knowlton. And in fact, in that story I just told about the Nayira deception, Frank Mankiewicz, last I heard, to this day, will say, oh, no, that baby killing really took place. Even though Hill and Knowlton went out and hired one of these big detective firms to prove that the baby killing took place, and their own detective firm came back and said, no, we couldn't find any evidence of it.
Yeah.
Frank Mankiewicz.
The truth is a liquid, John.
That's right. And Frank Mankiewicz is one of the top PR lobbyists in Washington, working in Washington for Hill and Knowlton.
His salary probably pegged to the minimum wage, I assume.
Yeah. Yeah, I think Frank's doing well.
I think
he's making a little more there than he did with National Public Radio.
Yeah, I think but the top people are in the seven-figure range, aren't they? I
mean, these, oh, certainly.
The heavy hitters in this industry. Because, I mean, I think that another thing about public relations, and trust us, where expert gets into this, a lot of the industries that are really have a heavy commitment to public relations are in public health and environment, where there's a substantial public regulation to protect the public interest, mm-hmm. where a change in a regulation, like with bovine growth hormone, can be the difference between a company having no sales or $5 billion or mm-hmm. $20 billion in sales. Mm-hmm. So if the stakes are that high for what you're doing, you know, you're going to be well compensated.
Well, that's exactly right. Corporations spend tremendous amounts on lobbying and public relations. And they spend even much more on advertising. For no one knows how many hundreds of millions of dollars, for instance, Philip Morris and the other tobacco companies have spent in the last half century confusing the public about the hazards of tobacco. But it's certainly been the most expensive, deadliest commercial PR campaign in history. They've spent hundreds of millions of dollars on it, but it's been worth every penny because mm-hmm. look at even today, Philip Morris is one of the most profitable corporations in the world. You know, tens of millions of people in the U.S. are still smoking, and now they're opening up markets in Eastern Europe and Asia where they're up to the same old tricks they used 30, 40 years ago and even convincing people that smoking might be good for your health in countries like China.
Can you give us just one more example, a more recent one? Some of our listeners don't have long memories, and they say, okay, that was back in the bad old days in 1990. How do I know this sort of stuff with PR didn't stop? We've gotten smarter. We've got the internet. We're hip to everything. You know, is it still going on? So can you give an example in the last 1, 2, 3 years of where public relations has really come in and deceptively changed public debate on a really important issue? I mean, it's done harm to our nation.
Well, we can look at the issue of genetically engineered food, for instance. Mm-hmm. I was talking about this cow growth hormone, the genetically engineered cow growth hormone. But that was just the beginning. In 1992, the U.S. government decided that here in the United States, genetically engineered food would not be subject to mandatory safety testing or labeling. So today, a decade later, all of us every day are consuming food that is not allowed to be grown or marketed in the countries of Europe, in Britain, in Australia, New Zealand, Japan. One of the stories we tell in our book is a prominent protein scientist by the name of Arpad Pusztai, who back in 1996 conducted one of the very few studies that actually tried to answer the question, is genetically engineered food safe or dangerous for humans? And I won't tell the whole story, but Arpad Pusztai found out that these genetically engineered potatoes decimated his test animals. So he gave an interview to the British BBC in 1996. He was on the air for a minute and a half, and he's a very conservative, very cautious, preeminent expert on proteins. And he said, look, I don't think that this food is proven safe. In fact, it decimated my rodents. I wouldn't eat it. And I think we need to do a lot more safety testing. Within 2 days, he was fired. He and his wife, a scientist at the Broad Institute where he's worked, were both subject to gag orders. A massive smear campaign was launched by Monsanto, the British government, his own institute. He couldn't respond. He was censored. 6 months later, colleagues of his replicated his experiment. The results were the same. The rodents were decimated. And that's one reason why in Britain, genetically engineered food isn't on the market. Here in the U.S., we've never even heard of Arpad Pusztai. We're picking up the newspaper and seeing full-page ads from Monsanto, hearing government officials echo this claim that genetically engineered food is the most tested technology in history, that it's perfectly safe, that there's no problem with it. Well, it may be the most tested technology in history, but almost none of the testing was human safety testing.
Yeah.
And just as we did with chemicals, just as we did with nuclear power, we are guinea pigs once more for a massive experimentation. That is getting no coverage in the media in the U.S. to speak of.
Okay, let me just bail off on that for a second and talk about that. We're talking with John Stavros, you know, the expert in public relations and author of the new book, Trust Us, We're Experts, with Sheldon Rampton, just published by Putnam Penguin. And I urge you all to pick up a copy if you haven't seen it as yet. What you're just talking about sort of gets at the term you used earlier, junk science.
Mm-hmm.
When I read this book, as with your Toxic Sludge and Mad Cow, what struck me was you could have 100 scientists, the leaders in the field, all come basically do research independently, come to one set of conclusions on a public health or environmental issue. Then you could have one of these AstroTurf PR groups with their sort of hack paid for people at some quack university come up with, you know, a position opposite that suits their paymaster. But then when you go to read the media, it's not presented as here are 100 independent scholars who've come to this position. It's the serious one. And here's the flat earth crew that's being paid to say this junk. Instead, what you get is the flat earth people are saying those other people are doing junk science.
Right.
And we're doing the real thing. And it's very confusing if you're at home. I mean, if you're reading a newspaper, if you're watching TV, or you're watching the O'Reilly Factor, or listening to Rush Limbaugh, or even a conventional news show,
mm-hmm.
and you're hearing someone who looks like they know what they're talking about say, our opponents, all the scientists in the world, are junks doing junk science, and we, this group that's paid for by this industry, which they don't tell you, are the real scientists. I mean, is that the goal, to keep you confused? I mean,
yes. Yeah,
okay,
that
good.
Is the goal.
It's working.
The goal is to keep people confused. And simply the way it works is, you know, if you pick up the New York Times and read about how this deadly environmental contaminant dioxin is so spread through the environment that it's a major contaminant in mother's milk, and it's at a level in mother's milk in the Midwest that is causing serious problems in test animals. That is something that's going to get you very concerned, as well it should. But that evening, if you turn on ABC 2020, and there's John Stossel.
No relation.
No relation. No, no. I am the good John S.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
There's John Stossel, you know, supposedly one of America's premier investigative journalists, but actually somebody who typically takes stuff from right-wing think tanks and industry front groups like Steve Malloy's junkscience.com. And John Stossel is saying, gee, dioxin is not a human health threat at all. And these companies like Ben & Jerry's that are changing their packaging to package their products in containers that are not from processes that create dioxins, they're just niche marketing. They're just trying to make themselves look like socially responsible companies. You know, this whole spiel. He did a program on this basically saying, don't worry about dioxin. People trust John Stossel. He's paid millions of dollars a year by ABC, and he's touted as an investigative journalist. The junk science here is what Stossel is passing on. But Stossel, who has done programs on junk science, hangs that label, as do most of the mainstream media, not on the chemical companies, not on products, you know, not on products manufactured by the tobacco industry, but junk science has become this tag for very serious human and environmental health concerns.
What's with the journalists here? Why are they not calling, saying what the truth is? Why are they regurgitating this confusing picture that makes it sound like there's a legitimate scientific debate of scholars who are studying the matter, rather than there's a sort of a consensus on an issue among all scientists, and then there's a paid-for hack group that's sort of urinating in the waters of science?
Well, I think that there's a number of things going on here. One is sort of this lazy sort of journalism that looks for the opposite position and pastes
a pro and con together.
Yeah. Labels that objective journalism.
Yeah.
And so you get this situation on, for instance, the debate over global warming. Well, in the real scientific community, among people who study climate, there isn't much of a debate. The debate isn't, is global warming occurring? The debate is, to what degree is industrialization a contributor, and how quickly is this happening? But what the petroleum and automobile and coal industries have done, again, spending probably over $100 million, these figures are secret. But if you look at the extent of the campaign and how long it's gone on, that would be a good estimate, is they create confusion. I mentioned this group, the Greening Earth Society, which is the
most recent attack.
That is a real group.
Okay.
And what's happened is global climate change has become so obvious. I mean, you live in Wisconsin. There's no ski industry in Wisconsin anymore. Your cross-country skis in a city like Madison have been on the shelf for most of the last 10 years because the climate is warming. The wood tick population is booming because the climate is warming.
Oh, yeah,
you can actually see it. So they've given up trying to convince people that global warming isn't occurring. I mean, you know, there's so much evidence,
yeah,
the superstorms, et cetera. So now their tact is, well, okay, it may be occurring, but scientists with an environmental group, the Greening Earth Society, say it's good for you. And the goal here really is to create a confusion so that public outrage can't be mobilized to force politicians and industry to address the problem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's really about controlling public outrage. There's even a formula that the PR crisis management experts use. We write about Peter Sandman in Trust Us, We're Experts. He's the PR crisis management expert who came up with this formula, and it's risk equals hazard plus outrage. The risk he's talking about isn't the risk of global warming or the risk of exposure to dioxins. or risks in eating genetically engineered food that hasn't been adequately safety tested, the risk is to the corporate bottom line. And what he's telling his clients is the key to protecting your bottom line is preventing the public from becoming outraged. If the public becomes outraged, then you've got a problem on your hand. But if you can sow confusion over issues like chemical contamination, global warming, food safety issues, you mute the outrage. And you know how it works. You know, you get together with the family at dinner and you say, gee, I just heard this terrible information about dioxin contamination of mother's milk, and now there's concern that this is an endocrine-disrupting chemical and developing infants are especially at risk. And somebody across the table says, yeah, there's nothing to it. Didn't you see the John Stossel report on ABC last night, America's most trusted investigative journalist? It's all a crock. This is all junk science. And it's like two waves crashing against each other. So sowing misinformation and confusion.
And unfortunately, our journalism does so far does a deplorable job. It seems to be it reports side A, looks for side B, and then rather than investigating to see which is telling the truth, or just the job of just presenting both sides is sufficient then to being a fair journalist. When in fact, that's just stenography. That's not journalism.
There are also the economic reasons for bad journalism that come into play, like the massive amount of money that the food industry pumps into TV advertising. Yeah,
Monsanto's bought a lot more ads than Center for Media and Democracy in Madison, Wisconsin, I suspect.
And, you know, it's not just Monsanto.
And while we're piling McDonald's, on here, John, we should talk about the fact that we've got a lot of politicians who are in bed with this whole system. I mean, I was watching TV very recently, and there was a member of Congress talking just about these issues, talking about all this junk science that the FDA is using that's sort of inhibiting companies from doing what they want to do, and using the term junk science, and being interviewed, and the journalist was giving this person a chance to talk. Of course, they had someone from the other side, but, you know, there was no discussion of who's contributing to this fellow's campaign. You know, none of the background was being brought out. So you were just leaving, thinking, yeah, it's just a debate going on, and you know, this is one of the two legitimate positions.
Well, one of the first questions we had to ask when Sheldon and I started reporting on the PR industry is, why aren't investigative journalists doing this reporting? Why does it fall to a small nonprofit in Madison, Wisconsin, to still, almost a decade later, be the only organization dedicated to investigating propaganda? And the quick answer is that academics who analyze how much of what's in our news every day is actually the result of these PR campaigns consistently come up with 40% or more of what we get as news is propaganda.
You know, we've got to leave very quickly. I just wanted to ask you one last question. What people are interested in these issues, what can they do? I mean, they can go to your website, I know, prwatch.org. And they can check out your publication, PR Watch. You do a spin of the day, which sort of gives an example almost every day of how PR is used to manipulate our thinking on fundamental issues. Anything else you'd recommend people do?
In all of our books, but especially Toxic Sludge is Good for You and Trust Us, We're Experts, in our last chapters, we try to address that issue of how do people in their daily lives recognize propaganda and how do we organize to address it.
John Stauber, our guest today here on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. And John, I want to thank you very much for joining us today to give us your insight, author of Trust Us, We're Experts, and I hope we'll be talking with you in the future.
Thank you very much, Bob.